Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
It's a great pleasure to welcome Alexandra Fuller back to the Roundtable this morning. Her critically acclaimed best-selling memoir, Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, An African Childhood, was a story told in vivid, sometimes excruciating detail of coming of age in Rhodesia as a long civil war raged around her and her family. Her prequel/sequel, Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness, rounded out her family's story, most specifically that of her mother, surely one of the most memorable characters of African memoir, according to the New York Times Book Review. Now comes her new book, Leaving Before the Rains Come, a book that in which she takes on the rise and fall of her own marriage and addresses how her father shaped her view of the world. It is a very funny book. It is beautifully written, as you've come to expect, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Alexandra Fuller to the Roundtable this morning.
Thank you for having me.
A delight to have you back on the program. Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Leaving Before the Rains Come. And was, do you feel that this was inevitable that you would write so intimately about yourself? You had written so much about your family that eventually you would have to sort of turn and say, okay, this is what has happened to me.
You know, I hadn't really fully realized how little I had written about myself until I wrote this book. And I think even then, you know, when you're in the process of writing, it's such a private, sometimes painful process. And then, you know, always I think that contract you have with the reader to keep it, you know, maybe entertaining is the wrong word, but, you know, no one needs to sit through your therapy session. and I think the absolute worst thing was realizing now I had to talk about it. And that's when I realized that I had written about myself, because it's so much easier to talk about my mother. She's so beguiling and funny and, you know, sort of larger than life. I know I don't think it was inevitable. I sort of thought that I'd dealt with myself. And,
right.
You know, yet here I am.
Don't you think things change, though, at your age? We're about the same age. We're in our 40s. And you've had a life, you've had a childhood, and then you've lived a life as well. And by no means is it over, but you do have more in the rearview mirror, which allows you to be able to address some of those things and put them into a context.
Yeah, I think I think that's a brilliant, brilliant point, right? I'm 46, halfway past the midpoint, and
right.
The way I've lived, I'm sure it's a little more than that.
And we never know.
You never know. Yes, and I think I keep saying this, my daughter's now 21, and now, at this sort of point, I can look back and say, gosh, you know, what you do in your 20s really sets you up for where you're going to be in your 40s. And I think where you are in your 40s will probably set you up to be where you are in your 60s, and how you are in your 60s is probably going to, you know, set you up for the end bit of life. And, you know, Carl Jung talks about this midlife crisis, and I think people sort of misinterpret that as, you know, you go and get a bad haircut and a sort of convertible, but it really is, I think, that moment where you have to take stock and say, is this really how I want to be for the rest of my life?
And also, and this is why I love the book so much, is that you get to examine your life as compared to your mother and your grandmothers and your great-grandmother, and to say, okay, because many will look and say, oh, well, you know, women have come a long way. And you say, okay, but really, how far have we come? And what is it about us that we pay and continue to pay this very large physical, emotional, and spiritual price?
Well, yeah. And thank you for seeing that in the book, because I come from this line, really on both sides, a sort of brilliant, ambitious, smart women who were stuck in the domestic realm. And then came my time to get married, and, you know, my parents had sort of raised me already dispossessed. You know, I'm a white Southern African, and it turned out I didn't even have a passport for the country that I loved. So it was as if I was living a sort of 1950s life, although I'm from a very different generation. But it's really as if I'm still in that old school. So I got to experience, you know, needing to fight for your right and your identity in, I think, a much more sort of old-fashioned way than most women are accustomed to fighting to. But in the course of that fight, and not just women, I mean, it's men too. Let's face it, your liberty is tied up with mine. It's, we're all in this together. You know, but in the course of that, I really realized, you know, I see a lot of what I call bumper sticker feminism, you know, well-behaved women really make history, whatever it is. And you see that on someone's, you know, bumper, and then you look in the car, and it's this exhausted, frazzled woman with three children trying to murder each other in the back seat. And she's, you know, you just think there is where, you know, where we're over-exercised, we're overworking, we're overtaxed, and we're doing it all. We are doing it all. It's not can you have it all. It's a matter of, you know, how much you can do before you just sort of hit a wall and say, "There's, pick your head up out of the diaper pail and say, wait, I still exist." Mm. And one of my favorite authors, I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly, Edwidge Danticat. She's a...
Oh, Edwidge Danticat. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Haitian.
Thank you. I just adore her work, and there's a line in one of her books that goes something like, somewhere, you know, every evening there's a mother telling her child her story, and at the end of it she asks, you know, not are you happy, but are you free, my daughter?
Mm.
And I think that's the question I want, you know, not just my daughters, but my son to ask, are you free? And what does that mean? What are the moral implications of your freedom, of having all this freedom we have in this country, freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of religion? And if, on the other hand, there's a sort of cultural straitjacket around you?
About 5 or 6 weeks ago, I knew I would be talking to you for this book, and I was reading in the New York Times, and there was a profile of you, and In the first paragraph of the profile, and I circled it and I put it on my desk because I knew I wanted to include it in the interview. And you say about women in their 40s that they have two choices about how to present themselves. They, quote, they can take Xanax, freeze their faces and not rock the boat, or they can behave badly.
I got into so much trouble for that quote.
It's a great quote, though.
Well, and maybe that's why I got into so much trouble. And although, don't knock Xanax, I tried it the other night. I was so anxious about book tour, and
God knows I would not. I would never knock Xanax.
I couldn't have felt anxious if I'd woken up to find myself pregnant with triplets. It was wonderful. But you know, I think I really think that, and that was, of course, I mean, it was a little bit tongue-in-cheek and an overgeneralization, but I'm really seeing that of women of my generation, that it, you know, and I don't, I mean, of course, do what you need to do cosmetically, of course, own yourself, own, you know, take your own journey, but I'm not seeing enough of us who, where is that instruction to be authentic, and we're not seeing it. You know, we're not seeing enough of that advertised. We're not seeing enough of that on in our books and our screens. And you know, that very real. It's an old sort of saying, something like, we always celebrate, you know, our dead rabble rousers, but society, but you know, our dead rabble rousers are not living conformists, and I think that when women, you know, kick away at the Botox needle, so to speak, I mean, that's, you know, you're owning what your life made you look like. You're, with all your battle scars and wisdom and anger and joy. And it looks as if I think it is a very threatening thing. I mean, as a wonderful South African womanist, she thinks feminist is too flimsy a word. She says there's nothing as frightening or as challenging as an African woman with a pen and a mouth she has no desire to control.
Mm. I want to talk to you about the writing of your marriage and its dissolution. I'm wondering what the challenges were of writing about your marriage, putting it in some context, and really writing about such a personal topic that involves your ex-husband.
Yeah. Listen, this is, wow. I mean, you sort of, this is the question that kept me up at night, right? I mean, it's not just my ex-husband, but these three children, beautiful, wonderful children. Obviously, everyone thinks that about their kids that, right, you know, we had together. And, you know, I think it's different for every person, but I think that for me, it's incumbent that the children be protected. And in so doing, their father needs to be protected. And so that was really the challenge. How do you write about a marriage that's dissolving when the last thing anyone needs to see, and certainly the children don't need to, and all their friends, and, you know, I have a personal life. I have very little interest in protecting myself. I appear not to have the enzyme that freaks out about how much people know about me. But, you know, I'm aware that that's not true for others, you know, for my children and particularly my ex. You know, and in the end, what I did was I wrote as full a portrait of him as I could, and then I took out everything that I wouldn't want my children to see. And I gave it to my, you know, my best friend, who's my children's guardian, really. And I said, read this, and if there's one thing that you think is going to make them upset or sad, I'll take it out. And so in a way, you know, my ex-husband comes across as he is, adventurous and loving and reliable and a wonderful father. And, you know, what remains in terms of, you know, how did this marriage collapse? I think everybody's marriage falls apart in more or less the same way. As far as I can tell from my, you know, unscientific polling, it begins to feel as if you're locked in solitary confinement with someone with whom you have this usually tremendous historic, you know, physical, actual, financial bond, but with nothing in common. And for me, it was a process, when I wrote the book, of really making it about myself. Not, you know, the other stuff, as we say in Southern Africa, save your breath and keep it for the therapist. I mean, the reader really doesn't need to know that. But for me, it really was, I think, the challenge of making it so that anyone going through this, of really, you know, of any gender, could look at this and go, oh, yes, I know that suffocation. I know what it is to feel gradually invisible in the face of this person with whom I have this connection. I know what it is to long for freedom and not even know what you necessarily mean by that. Now, this isn't a contract I gave up lightly. I mean, I was married for 20 years.
Right.
You know, three wonderful children. I worked as hard as I possibly could until I really believed that one of our lives were at stake. I mean, it felt that suffocating to me. Surely if I'm suffocating, he is. You know, it's not just the prisoner who's imprisoned, it's the prison guard too. And we just came from two such wildly different cultures. I'm, you know, outspoken. I'm, probably people would consider me eccentric. I'm exuberant. My ex-husband's very withdrawn, very conventional in many ways. Not that these are bad things. They're just not two things that can live in the confines of a small space.
You write in the book that marrying your ex-husband was a way to escape the chaos of your family's life. And you find out through the course of the book that that was not the case. But but did it give you a different view of your parents' relationship? Because that's also very much what the book is about, of giving you an idea of sort of relooking at the relationship that your parents have.
Well, it was so interesting because, you know, I had this, and I wouldn't even say it was a rocky marriage. It was a very silent marriage. And so I had this very silent marriage, which from the outside, heavens knows what anyone's marriage looks like from the inside, from the outside. But, you know, it very conventional. And then we did all those conventional things that you do to keep a marriage together. We had those ghastly date nights and those awful cards in which you're only supposed to say safe words, and we went on these couple weekends, and I nearly went, truly, if anything's good, and no one had a sense of humor about anything. I mean, God forbid you make a joke about marriage inside one of these things. And then there I have got these parents who lost three children, who you know, fought a civil war, which they lost, and, you know, all the complications of that I don't need to go into, that it was, you know, my mind, a horrendous war that they, you know, they were fighting for white supremacy. I mean, they are just wrong in every way. On paper, they're wrong, and yet they have worked so hard through, you know, through that sort of conventional wrongness. They're not, you know, they've worked through the racism of their early marriage and years. They've worked through the trauma of my father's, you know, I think it's fair to say he had pretty severe post-traumatic stress, which, of course, never got talked about publicly. They worked through all of that. My mother is the most terrifyingly glamorous woman you've ever met, and my flirting outrageously with all these other men, and my father would say, well, they're not my boyfriends. That looks like your mother's lookout. I mean, the freedom they gave each other, and the twinkle in the eye. I mean, there's this hidden thing between them that no matter what goes on, at the end of the day, they get each other, and they find each other hilarious. And exciting, and they're 75 and 70, and they're the most exciting couple, you know, I know. And yet they've done none of these conventional things. Trust me, there's been no couples weekends or little cards with what safe words and date nights. I mean, I can't even imagine. You know, and I phone home, and my dad's stomping off to the fish ponds to shoot a crocodile, and my mother's swatting away the mosquitoes and, you know, have malaria, and maybe that's it. They just have all this sort of real life to deal with, and they aren't really able to get caught up in the drama. I mean, the petty drama, I think.
So, in a nutshell, this is why you now live in a yurt in Wyoming.
It was going to come round. It was going to happen. It was inevitable. Well, you know, and I think that's the other thing. I mean, really, at the end of the day, this book is about, you know, a woman, me, who found herself becoming increasingly, you know, split. I was this person at home trying so hard to be safe and conventional and right and good. And then I'd burst out of doors and, phew, grab my horse and head up in the mountains and be able to be, you know, the woman my father raised me to be. And that woman, the bit that he missed, probably isn't conventional marriage material. Jane Austen would roll her eyes.
Well, the book is phenomenal. It's you're such a beautiful writer. It's a joy to read your story. The name of the book is Leaving Before the Rains Come. It is published by Penguin Press. Alexandra Fuller, a great pleasure as always to have you on the program. I wish you all the luck in the world with the new book and with your further adventures in this life we live.
Thank you so much. It was really a joy to be back on the show.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, Leaving Before the Rains Come, Alexandra Fuller. The book is published by Penguin Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.